Leaders are all around us, at all times and in every area of our lives. They motivate. They risk the first step. But what motivates a leader? In our Central Texas Leadership Series, KWBU has invited local leaders to talk with people they know who guide and inspire to find out what makes them tick. In this episode, Frederica Matthews Green, nationally known author and commentator on spirituality and public life, and presenter at the 2014 Baylor Symposium on Faith and Culture. Hosting the conversation is Professor Chris Hansen, director of Baylor University's Film and Digital Media Division. This conversation was recorded on October 24th, 2014.
Welcome to KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Chris Hansen of Baylor's Film and Digital Media Division, talking today with Frederica Matthews Green, author and commentator on spirituality and public life, and a presenter at Baylor's 2014 Faith and Film Conference. Welcome, Frederica.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Well, since you're here to speak at Baylor's Conference on Faith and Film, I thought we'd start out with a question about that. This is kind of a wide topic, whether we're talking about just depictions of people of faith in mainstream filmmaking, or the role that people of faith take in making films and influencing studios, or other, there's plenty of other aspects of the conversation as well. As a person of deep faith yourself, what do you feel is the role that film plays in society, how it influences, and how it should be experienced or not experienced by people of faith such as yourself?
I can't quote it exactly, but there's a line in the schedule, the itinerary for this conference that says, basically, film has taken the place of stage, drama, novels, so many other forms of culture in our society. And I think that's true, for better or for worse.
Right.
One of the things that happened was that literary literature, serious music, visual arts have become so elite and so refined that the average person feels unqualified to understand them, afraid to open their mouth. They'll say something stupid. But with the movies, that still has that wide appeal. If you're at a situation, at a party or something where people, there's ice to be broken, just mention the name of a movie and everybody's talking. They really feel qualified to engage with movie-type storytelling, however they approach it, however they get into it. And that's a beautiful thing.
Do you think that comes from the studios wanting to make movies because it's a popular art form that has to make money? And so the studios obviously are trying to appeal to the largest audience in order to bring people in. Is that...
That's true, especially concerned compared to, you know, serious art or serious music. But you think about books. I mean, there are a lot of stupid books published
every year.
Well, the best-selling book last year was Diary of a Wimpy Kid. So, you know, which is basically drawings. So I think it's making money always motivates people. But there's also the fact that movies have traditionally in America from the very beginning been aimed at every class of people. And I've been reading a really interesting book about the beginning of the movies, the 1895 movies and the 1903. And it says all through the teens, even into the 20s, movies were looked at as a lower class phenomenon. And references in novels of the era, well, if somebody went to the movies, it was the same as going to vaudeville. It was like a music hall. And, of course, vaudeville is where these short 5 and 8 minute movies were shown. So I think it's retained that for the common man quality for over a century now, and while at the same time becoming better and better and better as an art form.
I think as more and more people have decided to delve into that as the art form that they've chosen to express themselves in, there's greater and greater possibilities have come about. So certainly. Well, let's backtrack for a moment and talk about you, which is why, what we're here to do anyway. You're an author of 9 published books, columns and articles, an NPR commentator, a book reviewer, a movie reviewer, a well-regarded speaker, not to mention a wife, a mother, and a grandmother. So that all makes me wonder, what did you want to be when you grew up, and how did you get to where you are?
I was blessed to go to a school that was very supportive, And I was about in the sixth grade, I guess about 11 or 12 years old, when a teacher said to me, "You actually write very well. You know how when you're a kid, they give you the spelling words, and then you have to write a sentence for each word?" And I would challenge myself to actually make up a story that used all the words in sequence. And I had so much fun with that, that my sixth grade teacher said, "You know, this is really very good, and you need to keep going." And the school encouraged me all the way through 12th grade and all the way through college. And you know what happened when I graduated college? And I ended up going to seminary because I had a conversion to Christian faith at the end, right after I finished college. I didn't know how to get into the writing business, though. Mm-hmm. Of course, things are very different now than they were in the 1970s, but I could write all day long, you know, in my room on a legal pad, but how do you actually get it published? So I didn't try for quite a while. I had no idea how to get into the business. And mid-1980s, I had been pro-choice in college, but I got converted to a pro-life point of view strictly on the basis of abortion being an act of violence. It wasn't really a religious belief, but I didn't like pro-lifers. I was very snobby, and I thought, well, I don't want to associate to those people. They're the nerds, you know, they're the geeks. I found out differently as time went by. But when I heard there was an organization called Feminists for Life, I said, that's for me. I started editing their newsletter, found out that made me a vice president. Immediately, I was being called to be on CNN and C-SPAN and Primetime Live. I went zoom, you know, right up the escalator. And then I was expected to write. And what I found was that when I wrote articles explaining the feminist argument against abortion, the same reasons that Susan B. Anthony would give, I had editors coming to me and asking me to write. So I began writing, and I've written, man, the range is huge. Yeah. You know, it's humor, and it's reviews, and it's memoir. And I think this is the best job ever.
Does it satisfy you creatively? And I mean, artistically, but also some of it's not meant to be artistic, but to be able to write across all those genres?
Yes, it really does. And to have utter freedom, I know that I've got the best job in the world. Mm-hmm. My commute is walking across the hallway. it's really a lot of fun. And I think for me, it's I've been always a terrible athlete, never any good at that. But I think the joy I feel in putting words together must be like, you know, the joy the runner feels, you know, when he's running. But I just love it. I love playing with words.
That's a great analogy. I hadn't heard that one before, but I understand exactly what you mean. So, well, since we're on the radio anyway, let's talk about that for a second. What kind of commentary have you done for NPR, and what was it like to be somewhat of a conservative commentator on NPR?
Yes, that was... that was something that really impressed me about NPR, that when did this start? It was mid-90s, I guess. This was back in the days when you just took a little cassette recorder and on a tape you recorded something you wanted to say as a commentary on All Things Considered and put it in the mail. So that's what I did. And I wrote a little commentary sparked by a pro-choice commentary I'd heard kind of giving the other side about how abortion harms women. Well, to my amazement, they phoned, this is, you know, pre-email, and asked me to come in to record it. And when I walked in the building, the studio director there said to me, kind of tossed off over her shoulder, "We want this to be a regular thing. We'd like you to keep submitting." I mean, I almost stumbled with amazement. And they did. She encouraged me so much. And when there were times that they wanted to soften what I was saying, she would go to bat for me to say exactly what I meant. So it was, it ended up, you know, at first it was a number of pro-life pieces. But then she started saying, "We want to hear about your faith. This is the main thing. We want to hear how you live your life as a Christian, how you pray, what your church does, what worship is like for you." Who could ask for a better open door than that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was working on my memoir, Facing East, about a year at my church, and I used many of those pieces as commentaries. What a wonderful time that was. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were they interested in it as a kind of a view of a subculture that they weren't terribly familiar with? Or
I think that's okay. It. I think it was a little bit exotic, and also that it was breaking up some stereotypes about what Christians are
absolutely.
Like. Because this is an Eastern Orthodox church.
Right.
So there's a emphasis of spirituality or mm-hmm. icons or things like that that might sound, quote unquote, Eastern.
Yeah,
cool.
And there's, I think, a lot of in the lack of understanding of Eastern Orthodoxy and in around the country generally,
yes.
Unless you're in areas where it's popular. So, mm-hmm. Well, I want to go back to something you alluded to a moment ago. You're talking about the pro-choice movements and the pro-life movements, and you've been a leader in the conversation that tries to find common ground between
yes.
those two groups, which has often obviously been very let's just say there's not been a lot of common ground to be found. So I'll ask you what, given what you've told us about your approach and your initial approach, which was more based on the violence of it, what prompted you to lead out in that way to try and find this common ground?
Yes. I guess because I had been pro-choice and became pro-life, that sort of gave me a heart for reaching people who were like me, that unlike some pro-lifers, I think I could understand that pro-choice people arrived at their views in a serious way, that it wasn't flippant, that it wasn't, they weren't evil, they weren't like in favor of killing babies. I understood the way they thought. And so I wanted to see if we could talk to each other. As you say, there wasn't very much of that going on. And it's one of those strange things about how the media worked. I got an interview from a columnist saying, these two women are starting this Common Ground for Life and Choice. What do you think? And I said, I think it's a great idea. And you really gave it a boost. So in the column, it said, Frederica Matthews Green, a leader in the Common Ground movement. So a day later, I got a phone call from the two women trying to set this up saying, we understand that you're a leader in the Common Ground movement. So that's the power of the media.
You were declared a leader.
I know.
Yes.
I know. That's all it takes. So we did. We expanded this. We had two national conferences. At one of them, Naomi Wolf and I, did a shared presentation. And we had dialogue groups all over the country. Our goal was not to, get both sides to compromise a little bit, which is how many people understand the term common
right.
ground. We meant more like a safe ground or a demilitarized zone.
Conversation,
was yeah. it? I used to say we are trying to get past misunderstanding mm-hmm. so we can arrive at genuine disagreement.
For those who are just joining us, this is KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Chris Hansen, talking today with Frederica Matthews Green, author and commentator on spirituality and public life, and presenter at Baylor's 2014 Faith and Film Conference. Well, that's really fascinating stuff, and I think kudos to you for leading out in that way. I really feel that it continues to this day that what often happens is just a not just misunderstanding, but the idea, as you said, that people don't respect that other people have arrived at their views
yes.
from, a place that's natural
thoughtful.
Given their thinking and thoughtful. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And even if we disagree, that we can have thoughtful disagreement and understand where people are coming from.
Yes, I think that's important. And, of course, when people feel insulted or discounted, mm-hmm. it makes them angrier. And then that's, you begin to get a sort of get even thing going on. So we're trying to reverse that.
And so, but you've stepped away from that movement now. So can you tell us why?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It wasn't so much as stepping away. It was that the issue kind of got moved to the back burner.
Okay.
I remember that it used to be, pro-life, pro-choice was the cover story in
yes.
magazines, and it was hour-long TV shows and things like that. And I think perhaps the, when 1973 is when Roe v. Wade was released, and people had just sort of run out of patience with it.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like there was nothing new to be said.
Okay.
And the theory I had at the time, which I think has been proved true, is that when the argument got moved to the back burner, and was replaced by a different controversy du jour, probably gay marriage, and was like taking all that energy. My theory was that this would be a not inappropriate moment of silence, and that in that silence, people have very, even people who are pro-choice, have a lot of ambivalence about abortion.
Yeah.
Not only because we've seen sonograms now and we hadn't 40 years ago,
right?
But also because people know women who are basically corralled and pressed into abortion.
Mm-hmm.
My first book, Real Choices, I went around the country and interviewed women who'd had abortions and asked them, was there anything anyone could have done? You know, what would have made a difference? What did you need? And I thought I'd hear, I needed a place to live or I needed free medical care. But 88% of the time, they said, the reason I had the abortion was that somebody I loved told me that's what I ought to do.
Hmm.
Most of the time, the father of the child. And sometimes with an enormous amount of grief. Two women said, I was lying on the table praying that he would come back through the door and say, stop, I changed my mind. So I think there's this ambivalence is surfacing now that it's no longer, whenever the subject comes up, any pro-life point of view is associated with being, you know, the nerds and the geeks and the people you don't want to stand with on the playground.
Right.
Now that that has diminished, as you probably know, surveys are showing that increasing percentages of Americans are becoming pro-life or claiming the pro-life label.
Mm-hmm.
Pro-choice is shrinking. Pro-life is growing, especially among young people. It's never going to change very much with the baby boomers. You know, we're set in our ways. We're pretty old now, and baby boomers are not going to change. But sometimes when I speak on college campuses, I say the good news is that one day all of the boomers are going to be dead. And then your voice will be able to be heard once we get out of the way. So that's what happened. We were no longer able to get funding for the Common Ground movement because it had just been pushed to the back burner.
Oh, yeah.
But I think long run, maybe that moment of silence was a good and an appropriate thing.
Yeah. Well, and you know, I think that too many people don't respect that you need a moment of silence like you're describing sometimes.
Yes.
We've spoken, we've argued, and we may not agree with each other, but just continuing to argue the point is only going to cause everybody's blood pressure to go up and and people to check out of politics altogether.
That's
as
true.
A result. And then you lose voices that would be valuable.
Yes.
Well, I tell you what, let's get back to movies and modern storytelling since that's what brought you to Waco this time around. I know you've been here before. What do you think is the cultural importance of storytelling in our modern world?
Oh, storytelling is what everybody craves, isn't it? And perhaps it's because we have not very much of a sense of community anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We feel very alone. This is the price of absolute freedom, is absolute loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
It's that nobody has to care about you. That absolute freedom might sound fine if you're a non-spiritual 18, 20, 25-year-old living your life totally wild and with no obligations to anyone. But, you know, before you know it, you're 50 and then you're 60 and you're no longer attractive and people are no longer seeking you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're really alone and you realize that you're facing a pretty a sad and lonely part of your life. I noticed this in talks that I give, that there was a word I could use that would cause the audience to stop breathing. And I talk about all kinds of, I give talks about sex, I give, you know, all kinds of touchy subjects and things like that. The word is loneliness. That if I made a reference to loneliness, people would just, and it was as if, it was as if they were saying, she's talking about me.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have truly an epidemic of loneliness today. The wonderful thing about storytelling is it connects us with other people, perhaps fictitious people.
Mm-hmm.
But we're looking for narrative because it has a beginning and a middle and an end, and it's about other people. It draws us right in. I remember there's a moment in Tom Wolfe's book, A Man in Full, where man is angered his wife. He's off on his own. He's in this little basement apartment. And he is so lonely that he hears a couple arguing standing at their car up in the parking lot. And he goes over to the window just to listen, to hear human voices. It's as if we have unknowingly confined ourselves to, what's that called? Solitary confinement. Mm. Yeah, yeah. And that makes you crazy.
Yeah.
So I think that's one of the appeals of storytelling, is it weaves us back into the human community.
For those who are just joining us, this is KWBU's Central Texas Leadership Series. I'm Chris Hansen, talking today with Frederica Matthews-Green, author and commentator on spirituality and public life, and presenter at Baylor's 2014 Faith and Film Conference. Well, so what things, as someone who is a movie lover and a movie reviewer, what are the things that you look for in movies? Just what draws you to a movie now, to either something that draws you to make you want to see it, or that when you see it, you're like, that's connecting with me.
That's connecting with me. Yeah, it's sort of sad to say, but I think I felt much more of that's connecting with me in the 60s and the 70s. Both of those were terrific decades for movie making.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, yeah. The storytelling could be so bracing, and you didn't have to have a happy ending.
No, they were taking a lot more chances within the studios back in those days, yeah.
I think of two examples, Georgie Girl and Alfie, the original Alfie. Mm-hmm. Both came out in the 60s when I was just a high school student. But I just recognized the challenging quality of it and respected that. And I think what we have today is movies where the visuals are much, much better.
Yes.
Yeah, the photography, cinematography.
Amazingly.
The set dressing, the costumes. Yeah. The acting is quite good in most cases.
Much more naturalistic in many cases than it used to be. Yeah.
And so enriched. You can just turn off the sound and stare at the screen, and it's enrapturing. It's just wonderful to look at. And the stories are stupid. The characters are shallow. it's like the reverse of the Emperor's New Clothes.
Yes,
you know, it's like there's gorgeous apparel, but there's nothing inside. And I noted that especially with what was the name of that Magic in the Moonlight, the recent Woody Allen movie. Which. You know, how can you beat South of France, 1928? You could just, you know, I could put that on a loop. But the story was just stupid and obvious and broad. And Woody Allen is a gifted storyteller.
Very much so.
Gifted movie maker and screenwriter. We know he can do much better than this. Mm-hmm. But it's like our stories are just boiled down to formula now.
Yeah.
Perhaps in pursuit of many. Perhaps it's.
I was going to ask you, what do you attribute that other than, the pursuit of money? But Woody Allen is a good example to talk about there, because he's pursuing enough money for his films just to provide him the opportunity to continue to make films. And he's said that many times. He knows he has a small audience, and that audience is going to allow him a budget of X amount of money, and he can continue to do what he does. So he's not pursuing. He's not, I don't think, intentionally dumbing it down to reach an audience.
Right.
His audience is a fairly thoughtful and intelligent audience, I think.
So
to what do we attribute that?
What is it? Is he just getting a little, you know, dull? His edge getting dull in his old age or something like that? I thought this was an especially promising premise for this movie.
I agree. The concept was very interesting.
Yeah, in which 1928 world-famous magician Colin Firth, his friend who's a lesser magician, says, "You've got to come meet this girl. I don't know how she's doing it. She must be a fraud, but she's been telling me things there's no way she could have known." And so he does, and the Colin Firth character is a thoroughgoing skeptic, and there is no God, and there's no, you know, spiritual world, and there's nothing. And it's tiresome the way he keeps repeating these flat statements, so as if we're stupid. You know, we've already heard that. You know, he could just, instead of saying, you know, there is no God and Nietzsche was right, he could just say two, you know, because you've gotten far enough in the movie. You've heard this enough.
Right. You know, we've memorized all of
these. File by title, right? And so halfway through the movie, there's a, you know, suddenly he thinks, well, maybe she really does, you know, have this insight. Maybe there are powers. And it's totally unconvincing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you're halfway through the movie, so you know this is not where the story is going to end. It seemed to me very clumsy and very badly done. So why is Allen doing this when these are questions he's obviously wrestled with his entire life?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's a form of the same question he was wrestling with in Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Exactly.
About the existence of God.
And much and, better.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's a masterpiece of a look at a person wrestling with that question. Fascinating film. I wonder if, in his case, just having reached that level of being considered a master, he no longer has people challenging him when he's ready to make a movie. He just writes it and goes and makes it, and he doesn't have to.
Well, that's true, and that's the failing of many popular writers and movie makers and so forth.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I think we have time for one more question. So let me preface the question with some commentary. I've read a lot of reviews of movies at your site, which I really enjoyed your approach to reviewing movies. You seem always open to the experience, granting a movie the benefit of the doubt that it will do something to entertain or inform you. You're always willing to acknowledge the good points even in a movie that you otherwise might not have liked. Specifically, I reacted that way to your review of Pixar's movie Brave, where you were clearly disappointed by some of the stereotyping, by the choices they made in terms of the kind of story they were telling about the mother-daughter, but the marriage crisis element of the story being a stereotyped approach to a girl's story. But you also admitted that the movie – You kind of openly admitted the movie made me cry at one point, and not just a tear to my eye, but like I openly cried. So it feels to me like a lot of modern movie criticism or movie reviews, depends on what you want to call it, can't really balance expressing some disappointment but appreciating the positives. And I'm a filmmaker myself, and I see a lot of reviews that are you're either 5-star or you're 1-star. We love you or we hate you. So can you talk a little bit about your approach to that and what you see in the culture at large in terms of criticism?
Yes, I see what you mean. I think that, unfortunately, anytime you're dealing with a realm that has an intellectual element, there's always going to be some things that are kind of scrambling inside about pride, about showing that you're smarter than other reviewers, or showing that you're smarter than the movie maker. Mm-hmm. So I've always tried to be just very upfront about how it actually affects me, with nothing to prove, with nothing to shield or defend myself. And that's one of the things I enjoyed about Roger Ebert's reviews.
Yes,
he had almost a childlike quality. Very honest. Something I treasure from his review of Hotel Rwanda is he says, I find that when I am moved to tears in a movie, it's not when something sad happens. It's when somebody is good. And he said, go and you'll see what I mean. And I've thought of that so many times, that what really moves us is when there's an example of goodness. How the heart cries for that, to see goodness rather than the cynicism that surrounds us everywhere. So he's sort of somebody that I would like to be more like. I appreciate the simplicity, almost childlike defenselessness of the way he reviewed.
Yeah, what a great point. Ebert's reviews are like that. He had this tendency to be able to react to a film and to communicate his emotional state and be able to understand, as I'm saying about your film or your reviews, that the film might not be a good film, but I certainly reacted to it in a positive way. I remember reading that in his reviews a number of times, where he said, I know the story is something we've seen before, cliche, but it's nevertheless something that's good, and I responded to it. And I think being able to be open to the experience and not condemning so readily is something that we're losing somewhat in our culture. So thank you for writing that way. Well, we're about out of time. So thank you so much for making the time to talk with us today.
Thanks for having me here, Chris.
This conversation was recorded on October 24th, 2014.